"Tell Sam not to worry," he said, remembering his half-sister, the goddess of family, and more recently Jace's wife. After becoming involved with the rest of his family, he felt that there was nobody in the world he could trust with his younger sister than Jace. Jace simply chuckled, nodding his head as Keenan stepped through the rift in space. Almost immediately, an anxious voice spoke into his mind. "Jace, where did Keenan go? I just sensed something and he disappeared. Don't tell me he went outside the barrier." "It's fine, Sammy, don't worry," Jace consoled the worried sister. "A void monster snuck through the realm barrier and tried to hurt me, so Keenan is going to take care of it." "I'm sorry?" Suddenly Sam's voice turned a bit darker. "Something tried to do what now? Earth's realm barrier, right?" Jace's brow twitched, realizing that the two siblings were more alike than either of them realized. "It'll be fine, Sammy. You're more oriented for support than frontal combat. Besides, have some faith in your brother." There was a small huff from the other end of the connection. "Fine. I expect you to give me the full story when you get back later." Jace sighed, nodding his head. He mentally said a prayer to Terra, thanking her for the timely intervention. At the same time, he could only imagine the horrors being unleashed on the void monster outside of the realm barrier. Chapter 106. These days, it felt like there were fewer and fewer ways for me to personally get involved in the development of my world. As Tsubaki had implied before, we were now in an age where one man, no matter how strong or important, was ultimately less valuable than a large, well-trained force. Although my decisions could ultimately change the direction of the world's development, I did not want to take such overarching control. Doing so would be no better than depriving my people of their own freedom to choose their paths. Even if the title of keeper became more a decoration than anything else, that was fine. There were still certain things that only I could do, though the path the system wanted the world to develop seemed to be allowing mortals to acquire more and more of those abilities themselves, including the creation of a world. I doubted that the title of keeper would ever become wholly irrelevant, but it was certainly becoming less significant. For now, I was the equivalent of the highest authority of government, as opposed to the original concept of an absolute deity. Closing my eyes, I sat back in my office. My mind raced with ideas of what the future could hold, and how my role would adapt to those changes. Depending on what happened, I may need to prepare early on, as new developments could give rise to new threats that I would have to face. After a few moments, I stood up, glancing at Tsubaki, or rather the clone that she left with me while she worked on distributing the materials that I had given her previously. "I have a project that I want to work on. Please let your main body know that I'll be in the dungeon instance that Auravi gave me." "Understood, my keeper." Tsubaki's avatar gave a deep, respectful bow as I pulled the dungeon sphere from my inventory, activating it to enter an isolated space. There was something that I had always wanted to try, deep in the back of my mind. I had built up all of these skills necessary to accomplish it at this point. All that it required now was taking the final step to combine these skills. I calmly walked out of the instanced version of Olympus, holding my hand out. Perhaps because this was a big moment for me and I wanted to get it right, but I didn't use the divine circuits to handle this skill. Instead, I resorted to the old method, infusing my words with divinity. "Emerge, soldiers, both lifeless and formless. Rise to assume your roles as the vanguards of the future," I muttered, my illusion domain kicking in and creating an array of armor suits, 20 rows of 50 in total. This part was simple, barely consuming any of my divinity. Even the second step was relatively minor for me. "I bestow upon you all souls, so that you may carry out my commands." With this, my soul domain activated, and silver-white eyes emerged in the helmets of each suit of armor. At this point, they were sentient illusions, fully capable of possessing their own thoughts, though their souls were rather simple. I was looking for soldiers, not generals. Now, this was where things started to take a toll on me. Normal soldiers, even ones born of my illusions, would not be powerful enough to stand against future threats. If I were to send one of them out beyond the Hyperlane network wall, it would be destroyed in moments. Granted, they may have been created by my divinity, but their thoughts were not connected to my own. This was a safety mechanism to prevent memetic effects from infecting me through them. My shadow stirred beneath me, stretching out and to the right, as a great tower began to emerge. Once it had fully risen, its door opened, spewing out hundreds of books. My hand waved, a gust of wind gathering the books in midair, and beginning to distribute them. As each book landed on an armored knight, it began to sink into their bodies, merging with their souls. I could still feel the presence of the books, and new abilities could likewise be written on their pages. By my authority, I bind these tomes of divine power to this new form. Should any of you be slain, this book shall return, giving birth to a new holy knight, mirroring this creation. Once more I activated both my soul's and illusion domain, even throwing in the mirror's domain to create a trinity. I had to be very careful in the creation of these knights, ensuring that any connection between us only went one direction, which was me supplying power for them. There was no feedback, no mental connection that could be used against me. From the depths of their souls, they were created to be loyal to the title of Keeper, possessing enough intelligence to use the powers that had been bestowed upon them. Furthermore, because I set up the method to be recycled, they had little in the way of self-preservation instincts. They would willingly battle to the death to carry out their mission. You two. I pointed to two of the knights in the front row, who had respectively been given the tomes of light and wood. Fight each other to the best of your abilities. As soon as I said that, the two stepped forward. The Holy Knight of Light created a blade of light in his hand, while the Holy Knight of Wood stretched out his arms, creating a forest to obscure the surroundings. Regardless of this, I scanned the area with world sight to make sure that I was able to continue monitoring the battle. Or at least, I would have, had the battle lasted long enough. No sooner had my senses swept over the area before a burst of light cut down the forest, splitting the Holy Knight of Wood in half. To my surprise, a health bar even appeared over its head, showing that these constructs were recognized as life forms by the system. The health bar was quickly diminishing as the Holy Knight of Wood rushed in at literally light speed, slicing apart its opponent thousands of times in under a second. Its soul was destroyed, and I felt something stir within my divinity, both the drain of the powers used as well as my previous trinity being activated. A book rose from the shadows, silver light surrounding it, and forming a new Holy Knight of Wood. I nodded my head as I observed this process. "Excellent. You may stand down," I instructed the Holy Knight of Light, who seemed ready to continue the fight against the new knight. Next, I traced a finger through the air, drawing the outline of a large mirror. "Upon my call, all of you shall return to my side." In order to make sure that this was not a two-way link that could be traced back to me, I focused on embedding a small mirror in each of their souls, altering the previous trinity to account for this. This way, they would only be able to establish this connection when I created the matching mirror to summon them. Now there was just one problem left, and that was the individual abilities that each knight possessed. As seen in the previous fight, they were only able to use abilities that were already programmed into their tomes. However, there was a way to deal with this as well, and I knew just the person to rely on. Priscilla was on a pilgrimage, traveling by foot to the various cities and villages of Deccan. After her last mission, the Keeper had fallen silent, so she decided to take the time to inspect the land. With access to the abilities that he had already given her, she worried not for food or shelter, or for the dangers of the monsters that lurked within the world. At any point she wanted, she could immediately return to the temple. Priscilla, the keeper's voice suddenly spoke to her as she was sitting down, roasting a chunk of meat over a campfire that she made on the side of the road. Priscilla's eyes widened, and she jumped to her feet, extinguishing the fire so as not to distract herself from the coming conversation.
"I am at your service, Lord Keeper. What would you have me do?"
she asked, in a devout tone, placing one hand over her heart to show her fealty. "I have another task for you, one that I can only feel safe entrusting to you among all the mortals of the world." Priscilla's smile grew as she heard these words, the sign of faith that the Keeper had in her. "I have created a regiment of holy knights from my divine power, each of which possess an immature domain. These domains are tied to the same tomes that you and the other priests have access to." Priscilla's eyes widened, already anticipating the words that were coming. "I would leave these soldiers under your command for training. Their minds are simple, and they can be considered golems. If one dies, it is reborn by my power. Thus, they require a competent commander, someone familiar enough with how my power works, to grant them what they would need in times of crisis. As part of this assignment, I am granting you unlimited access to bestow abilities upon these knights. Are you willing?" When the Keeper asked that, Priscilla immediately nodded her head.
"Of course, Lord Keeper," she thought back fervently.
As soon as she sent her confirmation, a glistening mirror appeared before her, widening until it was nearly 50 meters wide. She could hear the sounds of marching as rows of knights emerged from the mirror, all wearing shimmering silver armor. Despite the sounds that came from their march, the grass was not disturbed by their passage. Immediately, Priscilla was able to discern that the bodies of these creations were mere illusions, as were the sounds produced by their movements. The real substance, the force behind these knights, should come from the divine powers that the Keeper had mentioned. Once 1,000 knights emerged from the giant mirror, it shattered, and the knights all knelt before her. "These are my holy knights. As my priestess, you should be able to differentiate which one has which domain." Priscilla nodded her head, focusing on her connection with the Keeper, with the books that she had previously written powers in. Following that connection, she was able to sense a single book within each of the knights, and make out which knight possessed which book.
"I will do my best to carry out your assignment and live up to your expectations, Lord Keeper," she responded firmly, already thinking of ways to improve the abilities of the knights.
Although she herself could still only use the single power that she inscribed in each tome, she could read the abilities present in all of them. Some were currently not suited for combat, while some were not suited for anything but combat. In order to properly carry out her assignment, Priscilla felt the need to bestow each and every knight with abilities that could let it carry out a variety of missions. They would still be specialized, but that did not mean that they had to give up all else in the face of their specialization.
"All of you, rise," she commanded,
and all 1,000 knights rose to their feet in perfect unison. She walked down the line, moving until she had reached the Holy Knight of Fire.
"We'll start with you," she said, placing a hand on the knight's chest and focusing.
Although her pilgrimage wasn't completely over, it would appear that she would need to put it on hold for the moment, at least until she was confident that these knights would not disappoint the Keeper in battle.
Chapter 107
The development of the holy knights was not a matter that could be settled quickly. In fact, Priscilla used the power of these knights to create a temporary barracks out in the countryside that she could use to train them, letting them practice and showcase their new skills by hunting local monsters. This process took several weeks, during which several new innovations took place. First of all, the temporary realm for the Mitong had been established. Though it was little more than an infinite expanse of cosmic dust, it was a stable enough world that it did not appear it would collapse easily. Next, a new creation had appeared, seemingly from nowhere.
Like with the information blocking shield, Tsubaki provided this machine directly to several research teams, 10 in total. These were red and black platforms, each with 6 blue cylindrical crystals slotted into them. According to the information from Tsubaki, these devices were meant to monitor the entirety of the Internet, identifying any memetic traces. At the sign of such traces, they would be immediately censored from public view and the relevant authorities notified. Their job was simple: study the machine to determine if there were any hidden mechanisms in place, and then create a port to connect it to the Internet. Studying its construction could be considered a long-term project. After all, they could reproduce the machine endlessly with digital conversion. The next development was one that most of the public was unaware of, and that was the spatial compression device created by the Mitong and March collaboration. These devices went into immediate mass production, capturing not only the planets of their subjects, but their entire solar systems. Throughout all of this, the dimensium fluctuations had only grown stronger and stronger. By the time that they began securing their planets, the dimensium of their world had stopped functioning entirely for hours at a time, the frequency becoming faster and faster. Finally, there was one last invention. This was known to the public. The information barrier had finally been adapted to work in modern vessels, and the first unmanned tests were a success. For the first time since the sacrifice of Giles, people were able to explore and expand beyond the known systems. Udana let out a sigh of relief when she heard that the golems had created the tools necessary to begin the evacuation procedures. It would still take some time before they were able to fully evacuate their entire empires, but they had everything that they needed at this point to get started. As for the time that they had remaining, Udana wasn't entirely sure. It was possible that the universe would collapse when dimensium became entirely inert, or that it could happen either before or after that point. This was the first time that a universe had collapsed slowly rather than from a single immediate event. They didn't really have a frame of reference to go by. The best that she was able to do was to have the fallen gods under her command maintain the realm barrier to the best of their abilities. Everything else was left to fate.
"Now this is what I'm talking about," Lyphra laughed as she sailed through the air, navigating between strange hovering bubbles of energy that detonated with remarkable force if anything drew near. These bubbles all but filled the sky, and triggering the wrong one could lead to a chain reaction if she wasn't careful. Behind her, Petra's face was pale, doing her best to keep up with the slime. "Why are you doing this?" the demoness asked, in a near-panicked tone. "Because it's fun!" After completing her mission on the 64th floor of Fior, identifying the likely route that James took when traveling to the world's natural energy core, Lyphra moved on to the next floor. This floor appeared at first devoid of life, but this was only at a first glance. Throughout the sky, bubbles of energy fluttered about, exploding with the force of a sizable bomb if they were provoked. Through careful study involving the pointy bits of her sword and trying to destroy the bubbles before they popped, Lyphra discovered that these bubbles were actually a type of life form. It took her some time to learn how these creatures functioned, mostly because of how hard it was to study them without them blowing up in front of her. However, she had a good idea of things now. When they exploded, these monsters weren't really dying. Instead, it was akin to a puffer fish inflating itself, trying to ward off predators and making itself an unappealing target. After detonating, the energy that created these bubbles gradually reformed, the bubble again appearing in the air, where it had originally detonated. Lyphra had tried to communicate with these creatures, but every attempt led to explosive results. Due to this, she had determined that the creatures were very likely non-sentient monsters. Her inner adventurer urged her to tame such a fun monster, keeping one as a pet. However, her inner child disagreed.
and had what she argued was a better plan. She grabbed Petra, bringing her to this floor, and decided to explore together, flying narrowly between packs of what she was calling bomb bubbles. Every time the sky was filled with explosions, Petra's face went pale. Even as gods, she knew that they would not come out entirely unscathed if they were caught in those blasts. "Please tell me that there is a reason for this, other than the excitement of being next to a living bomb," she shouted, yelping when the noise triggered another wave of nearby blasts. Lyphra paused, thinking to try to come up with some excuse.
Maybe there is some special energy or artifact that gave birth to these creatures. You know, like on the 61st floor.
Petra's eyes narrowed at that, her body stiffening. Although she had the distinct feeling that this was not Lyphra's true objective, she couldn't deny the possibility that such a thing could happen.
"Shouldn't we be using your compass, then?"
"Nah, no need."
Lyphra shook her head quickly, as that would only end her fun faster.
"We just have to fly where the biggest bomb bubbles are. Ooh, there's one."
Her eyes widened, seeing a massive bubble in the distance, spanning more than a kilometer wide. Given that most of these bubbles were no more than 10 meters in diameter, this could easily be seen as a local boss monster.
Wait!
Petra's eyes widened, trying to call back Lyphra. "We should detonate it from a safe distance. If the explosive force of these things could be measured by their volume, you could fit hundreds of thousands of the little ones in that." Seeing Lyphra's eyes sparkling with anticipation, Petra slapped her face, deciding to take a different approach.
"You can't appreciate the fireworks if you pop it up close," she said. And Lyphra finally stopped moving when she heard that.
You're not wrong." "Dang it!"
Lyphra stomped her foot in midair. With a huff, she pulled out a longbow, a golden string of energy appearing that she pulled back. Golden light flowed through the string, forming a dense arrow that flew into the distance. Petra let out a sigh of relief when she saw this, but still braced herself. As soon as the arrow touched the giant bubble, the surface rippled and popped. There was a brief lull before black energy erupted. Petra's eyes widened, realizing that this was different from the previous blasts. This energy swept out, seeming to devour the nearby bubbles. Petra focused, wrapping both herself and Lyphra in shadows, to immediately pull them into the shadow world. Only once they were safely within the shadow world did she let out a sigh of relief.
"Oh, that was a nice boom," Lyphra said with sparkling eyes,
which only further stood out in the dark landscape.
"That shouldn't have been the same type of monster," Petra said, furrowing her brows. "It appears that it preys on the other creatures."
"Bomb bubbles,"
Lyphra interjected, but Petra ignored it.
"By having a similar appearance, they lure the other creatures in, so that they can absorb them to grow stronger. That one is likely quite significant, with how large it is."
"Oh, you mean that they could be mixed in with other bomb bubbles?"
Lyphra asked enthusiastically, to which Petra nodded her head.
"It's possible, and they likely wouldn't be mixed in with groups. If they're in a group, they would have eaten the others. Any of the predators would be isolated." That explained why they hadn't encountered any thus far, as Lyphra had insisted on taking the more thrilling path.
"So, if we follow these things to the source, we'll find something interesting?"
Lyphra asked, as if having not paid attention to the major points of what Petra was saying. Petra simply let out a sigh, nodding her head.
"That's right," she agreed reluctantly.
As much as she was wary of this place, she knew that this floor would eventually be occupied like the others, and needed to see if there was a way to do so safely.
"It should be safe to exit now."
Shadows once again wrapped around the two of them, depositing them on the ground some distance away from their previous position. Looking up and into the distance, Petra's expression was distorted. There was a black cloud where they had previously been flying, one that looked as if it spanned hundreds of kilometers. Slowly, this cloud was pulling back towards its core. Wherever it passed, none of the previous bubbles remained, having no doubt been absorbed into the black mass.
We should avoid any of these predators going forward. Lyphra pursed her lips, briefly pouting before nodding her head. Even she had felt a sense of danger when the black energy had approached.
Fine. But I want my objection to be noted.
It's noted, Petra nodded with a low sigh. Finally, she felt as if this adventure might become more bearable.
Well, you said that they don't appear in groups, right?
Lyphra asked with a sudden grin, and Petra's face became pale once again. Before she could object, Lyphra had grabbed her wrist to pull her through one of the densest groups of bubbles.
This isn't what I meant, Petra shouted, as explosions once again began to ring out in her ears.
Lyphra, meanwhile, was simply laughing as she flew through the explosions. In the distance, she could see other isolated bubbles, which she assumed were likely the predators. Some were small, others even larger than the first that they found. Keeping an eye on them, Lyphra navigated her way through the clouds of bomb bubbles, trying to move towards where she assumed more and more of these predators had come from. Petra was too busy trying to drown out the explosions ringing around her to notice exactly where Lyphra was taking her. As far as she knew, Lyphra was flying around aimlessly, trying to have more and more fun while dragging her along for the ride. And to be frank, she wasn't completely against it. The fact that Lyphra had dragged her into this showed Petra that Lyphra thought of her as a friend, which she liked. She just wished that her friend had more normal hobbies than flying through massive landmines.
Chapter 108. The slime and demoness duo continued further and further through the bubble-filled skies, a chorus of explosions following behind them. At this point, Petra had all but become numbed to the blasts. Lyphra had a talent for skirting the very edge of danger, allowing herself to enjoy the thrill of the scenery without actually placing herself in immediate harm. Of course, with that said, she was able to notice over time that the groups were becoming less and less dense. When this fact became apparent, she took note of all of the isolated bubbles floating in the sky. A chill ran down her spine, realizing that Lyphra hadn't given up on her goal of searching for the source of the predator bubbles. Petra gulped thickly, ready to pull the two of them into the shadow world again at the slightest indication that something was wrong. With less obstacles in their way, they were able to begin vastly increasing their speed, the surroundings starting to blur around them. Soon Petra noticed that there were only isolated bubbles around them, some of them ranging from mere centimeters to over 5 kilometers wide. There were times when they came close enough to cause these isolated predators to pop, but their greatly enhanced speed allowed them to actually outrun the explosion of black energy by simply continuing to travel in a straight line. Of course, that also meant that they were going far too fast for their voices to reach one another and were forced to rely on mental communication.
There's something up ahead, Petra suddenly spoke up, sensing something stir within the shadow world. It was never a good thing to find something that was capable of upsetting the world's shadow, so she had to be cautious. Lyphra nodded her head, but only increased her pace. Merely a few minutes later, they had arrived at their destination. On the ground before them sat a massive pool of what looked to be tar, spreading out like an ocean as far as the eye could see. Every now and then a black bubble would rise from the tar-like substance before shifting and shedding its black color, becoming translucent like the other bubbles.
I don't like this, Petra said, clenching her fist. Lyphra, we're not poking that. There's something wrong here.
Lyphra had already drawn her bow, looking back at Petra with an exasperated expression.
Fine. What are we doing, then?
I'm taking us to the shadow world. There's something wrong with this location.
As she said that, the two vanished, wrapped in darkness and disappearing. Within the shadow world, Petra was immediately able to tell what the problem was, her red face going several shades paler. Meanwhile, Lyphra looked around in confusion.
What's wrong, Petra? You took us somewhere else. Was it really that dangerous there?
She looked at the giant valley beneath her feet,
nearly 1,000,000 kilometers away, as well as the deep canyons that ran through it.
I didn't. This is the same place,
Petra gulped, turning to look around. This valley ran to the ends of the horizon in all directions.
You mean that tar pit wasn't part of the landscape?
Lifra tilted her head. Thanks to the Keeper, Petra and Dana, Lifra had some understanding of how the world's shadow worked. By default, it would copy all natural and man-made structures created at the time of its conception, whether they were mountains, buildings, or even entire oceans. However, it would not, by default, copy supernatural energy sources or creatures, and the person with the world's shadow had to instruct it to do so.
That's right. It's either a solidified energy construct.
Petra froze, not wanting to finish that thought. Thankfully, or unfortunately, perhaps, Lifra picked up on her intention.
Or it's a creature. A single bubble that massive?
What?
Are all those predators just its kids or something?
It's possible.
Petra couldn't deny the claim, as that was certainly where her mind was going as well.
I'm going to take us back there, and I want you to scan it. I know you're better at that than I am, so try not to provoke it. We need to determine what we're dealing with before we decide how to proceed.
If there was a single creature that large, constantly spawning these smaller bubbles that could even endanger older gods, that alone could be reason to abandon colonization of this floor, at least until such a creature was able to be eliminated. Lifra nodded her head, crossing her arms and putting away her bow. When the two returned to their former location, she immediately swept her senses over the creature with her world sight, pursing her lips and furrowing her brow.
That's strange,
she said, causing Petra to wonder what she had discovered.
This creature, and it is a creature, by the way, its mana content is too high. I'd say that at least 90% of its makeup is pure mana, and it is using that mana inefficiently to convert into these bubble predators.
Petra hesitated when she heard that, not sure what to make of it. Following the natural process of evolution, a creature like this should not be both so powerful and so wasteful at the same time.
Have you ever seen anything like this before?
Just once, she nodded her head. I scanned a lightborn once, curious how they worked. It was a lot like this, made almost entirely of mana that was being used to produce other effects.
Petra's eyes widened at that realization. It had been a long time since the Lightborn had played a major role in the world, but they could still be seen in various places of Fior as a minority. However, she was well aware of their origins.
You mean that this thing is a giant mana siphon turned into a creature?
That seems like it would be the most plausible answer.
Yeah.
Lifra nodded her head in agreement.
But what would have been able to create such a giant siphon?
What about those other bubbles?
Bomb bubbles!
I'm not calling them that, Petra huffed, shaking her head.
Would it be possible that they were able to create something like this, if they were given enough mana to work with? Lifra paused, thinking it over.
It's possible, she nodded her head. There's not a vein here for mana that I've seen, but there is one other major source of mana in this area.
As she said that, she glanced off into the distance. Even with its massive height, the mana pillar of this world couldn't be seen from their current spot.
But for that energy to reach all the way here before forming a siphon?
Petra wasn't sure how it was possible either. If a mana siphon of this scale were to occur, it would be closer to the spire itself.
Well, are the other bubbles?
Bomb bubbles!
Still not calling them that, Petra groaned.
Are they also siphons?
Lifra shook her head at that question.
I've scanned them a few times. They appear to be normal energy life forms.
Petra could only think of a few possibilities. The first was that there was a civilization that existed here in the past, or at least some form of sapient species. If that were true, their collective thoughts and fears of the bubble creatures could have been enough with a surge of mana to give rise to something like this.
Another possibility was that there was simply no other form of life on this layer than the bubbles in this area, so the siphon had nothing that it could fuel itself with aside from these creatures and their primitive thoughts. The third option was a combination of the two, which would imply that the bubbles themselves were a sapient race, and they had just not noticed until now. With those thoughts in mind, Petra began to go over what she could observe. Any structures in the area could have reasonably been blown away long ago due to the repeated blasts of these bubbles, leaving nothing to be discerned in the present day. However, the actions of the bubble creatures did not really strike her as those of intelligent beings. They avoided the predators on sheer instinct, but didn't otherwise act, aside from merely blowing up whenever anything other than one of their own came close to them. If anything, the predators showed a higher level of intelligence, able to mix in with their prey and consume them.
"Maybe there's another one of these things for the bomb bubbles?"
Lyphra suddenly asked. Petra blinked, finding it unlikely, but certainly not impossible. They had already established that the other bubbles weren't the result of a mana siphon, but if it was a collective consciousness, it might have enough mana fluctuations to trigger a siphon. Petra scanned the area with her eyes, looking for other clues that could answer her question. As her eyes shifted, they suddenly widened.
"There's somewhere that we haven't considered yet," she said, and Lyphra looked over in interest.
Petra's head tilted back, eyes turning upwards to look at the sky, high, high above them. Even as gods, the sky was so far away that simply the atmosphere itself was enough to obscure their vision. If there were traces of civilization on the ceiling, they would never know without heading up there to check.
"Oh, that's right," Lyphra's eyes widened in realization. "These guys are all about floating all over the place. It would be normal for them to live at the top."
The slime girl grinned, grabbing Petra's arm again. Before the demoness had even a moment to realize what Lyphra had in mind, the two were sailing into the air. The air pressure shattered against their skin again and again in rapid succession. They ascended so fast that Petra could feel the heat of it, a cone of flame appearing ahead of them. When they finally stopped, the air cracked, rushing out in all directions and shattering the remains of several ancient buildings. Petra sighed, planting a hand on her face as she saw all of those piles of rubble falling towards the surface.
"Well, we can confirm that the bubbles are sapient now."
"Were? And they're bomb bubbles!" Lyphra crossed her arms, pouting. "But anyways, they were sapient."
She scanned the surroundings with her world sight, able to discern that this area had not seen active use in a very long time.
"What happened here?"
Petra wasn't sure how to answer that question. If they had found a bubble city up here, she had expected that it would be actively occupied. However, there was no trace of a single bubble creature, whether predator or normal, anywhere nearby. And not just because they had gotten scared by their arrival, either. Looking down, Petra noted that she couldn't see any bubbles anywhere close enough for her to observe.
"This is going to take some proper research as to what happened. What I'm worried about is currently something entirely different."
"Oh, is there something even stranger going on?"
she asked, and Petra pointed downwards. "How many of those remains are going to burn up as they fall, and how many will survive to crash into the super bubble?" Lyphra blinked, looking down, and blinked again.
"On the bright side, that should take hours for them to reach the surface, maybe days, even. At which point, we will be far, far away."
Chapter 109. After retreating from the ruins of what Lyphra had started calling Bubbleopolis, the duo reported their findings to the Adventurers Guild. They mentioned the estimated level of the bomb bubbles, which Lyphra had managed to get officially named, much to Petra's dismay, as well as their predators and the information about the ruins. This was a rare chance for the guild to investigate a fallen civilization. Even now, there were still many people looking into the ruined civilization on the 61st floor, which had ultimately brought chaos to that entire floor, making it uninhabitable until the world spirit cleaned the area.
Those capable of surviving on the 65th floor while possessing the education needed to study such ruins naturally went to investigate first. There was no telling how long it would take to get a definitive answer about what happened, but Lyphra had already left to resume her adventures. I let out a small sigh, sitting at my desk and reading through the reports. Learning about yet another ruined civilization didn't exactly fill me with much hope for what we would find further on in the higher levels of Fior. Thankfully, the Hadjit proved that there was still a decent chance of finding something good, but the odds seemed painfully low. If not for them, I would likely believe that there was some influence seeping in from the upper floors that just naturally led to the ruin of civilization. At the same time, I had a report from Priscilla, who gave me a detailed list of every divine power that she gave to each of the 1,000 knights. For the most part, I skimmed through this list, as there was no need to memorize each individual option, especially not when I can just observe the knights directly by focusing my attention on the books embedded within them. My main interest was on whether or not any of them had been given particularly interesting abilities. As I was setting the reports down, I heard a knock from my office door. Turning back, I saw that Tsubaki was there, hands folded over her stomach. "Come in, Tsubaki," I said with a smile, and she nodded her head, entering the office. "Is there something wrong?" "Yes and no, my keeper," she said, before beginning to explain. "The device that you received in the recent trade with Bellarose has been activated and connected to the Internet." "That sounds like a rather good event," I pointed out, one eyebrow raised. "So what is the problem?" "It would seem that there was already a serious infection of memetic information within the Internet," Tsubaki said, my eyes widening a fraction. "Upon investigation, roughly 3% of the information available for public consumption was infected with some form of memetic trace." 3% didn't sound like a lot, but this was a network that spanned multiple universes and dozens, if not hundreds, of occupied planets. How hasn't there been an outbreak, if it is that widespread? Due to the seriousness of the case, Chelsea was called in as an expert on the subject. Upon review, she noted that the vast majority of the infected information was benign, with very little that had any true effect. For instance, she found a conspiracy theory posted on an unpopular forum that caused others to instinctively believe it, and things of that nature. Additionally, due to the device connecting to multiple public cameras, 63 cases were confirmed of graffiti containing memetic influence across the various worlds. All of these incidents have been reported, the relevant authorities notified and dispatched to remove the potentially hazardous content. I nodded my head when I heard that. It was the right call, though some of that graffiti may have been done with benign intent as well, like a marketing team just trying to enhance their product's sales. Regardless, even Chelsea had learned not to carelessly use memetic scripts, and she was an expert in the field. "Got it. Is there anything else?" I asked, to which Tsubaki paused.
"There is. A report from Dana. She said that her new device is ready. She's just ironing out a last-minute kink and can present it to you at any time."
"New device?" I blinked, knowing that Dana was working on some project, but I had no idea exactly what said project was. "Is it something for Olympus?"
"It would not appear so."
Tsubaki shook her head. "She said that this device was designed to help normal law enforcers battle criminals on the level of gods."
"Well, that was certainly interesting."
"I see. In that case, let's go check it out," I said, happy to stop reading over reports and get moving to see a real interesting demonstration. Tsubaki gave a small bow, nodding her head and turning to lead the way. The two of us walked to the gates of Olympus, where she tore open a portal for us to step through. When we arrived, I swept my senses out to the surroundings to try to determine our present location, and found that we were at the Another World Research Group's home planet. Presently, we were standing near the edge of a large cliff, surrounded by a rocky plateau. There was a large device set up that looked like a medical pod, filled with translucent green fluid. Nearby, Dana was adjusting a metal bracer that rested on her arm, smiling as she noticed us.
"Hey, boss. Decided to come and see what I made, huh?"
"That's right. I heard that you made something rather interesting," I asked, directing my attention to the medical pod and the device on her arm. "What exactly do you have prepared for this demonstration?"
"Glad you asked," Dana grinned, lifting her arm to showcase the bracer. "I call this the reset protocol. Have you ever had to deal with a criminal too powerful to contain? Someone that's just another one of those pesky gods or saints? Tired of having to repair broken cells and wards? Worry not, for we have the answer. Packed inside this little bracer is a card activator and stasis chamber. The card inserted into the bracer is a common capture card, already popularized by Deccan law enforcement, and has spread to numerous worlds due to its ease of use. The activator focuses the effect of the card into a beam to fire at the criminal. When they are hit, they will be trapped in the card, which is itself kept within a stasis chamber to prevent the contained criminal from having the time to escape. Not sounding particularly new so far, I said with a grin, one which Dana immediately returned.
Oh, but wait, there's more. The capture process is only step one of the reset protocol. Allow me to direct your attention to the larger device installed next to me. This is your standard cloning vat, with some modifications made by yours truly. These changes allow the device to take the primary energies from the containment card and use those to print a new body for the captured criminal. But wait, why would you waste all the resources printing a new body when they'll just break out again, you might be asking? This is a physical body, not an energy one, and it is printed from the captured criminal's own energies. Furthermore, the device is structured to print the body as a completely mundane mortal that doesn't even have their first level. Naturally, there will be some overflow, whereas a god will become a demigod or powerful individuals will retain their talents. However, even a demigod is weaker than a child if they don't have the levels or energy to supplement that talent. Once their new body is printed, the consciousness of the captured individual is naturally transferred due to their energy being used as the basic template of this clone. From there, all you need to do is slap basic energy nullification restraints on the target, and they will be unable to muster the powers they once possessed to break free. I'm sure you were all thinking that this is too good to be true, turning a god into a mortal to punish them for their sins. Well, thankfully, I have prepared a demonstration. As she said that, she inserted her arm into a circular hole within the medical vat, one which the bracer perfectly slotted itself into. For the purposes of this demonstration, I had to go and hunt down a rather troublesome criminal, a god of poison that spreads a poisonous gas within smaller villages he passes through, or lures monsters to attack them, all for the sake of harnessing their hatred for him to produce even more deadly poisons. As Dana explained all of this, the medical vat was suddenly lighting up. Within the green liquid, I could see a body being printed, clearly using the digital conversion system rather than regular cloning technology. There must have been some complication that she couldn't resolve without switching to this system, but that was fine. So far, his confirmed crimes are as follows. 3,976 counts of first-degree murder. 13,205 counts of intentionally luring monsters to attack non-combatants. 108 counts of kidnapping. 6 counts of assault, 5 counts of evading arrest. The body that was printed was that of an elf, with long green hair and red eyes. He looked as if he was asleep within the vat when Dana removed her bracer from the device. Focusing my gaze on him, I confirmed that his level was currently 0, though he was also listed as the demigod of poison. For such serious crimes, the normal punishment would be death, Dana said in a firm voice, clearly annoyed by seeing the man again. I could only imagine how hard tracking him down must have been for her. However, there are few capable of reliably killing a god, especially without resorting to extreme measures that could negatively impact the surroundings. Someone like him can escape a normal capture card in roughly 18 seconds, which was why the stasis chamber is necessary. These are the individuals for whom the reset protocol is designed for,
those so drunk on their own power that they cannot be contained by normal methods, and will do as they see fit without concern for others. For this reason, I have decided a more fitting punishment for those that care for power over life. Rather than killing them, their punishment will be the death of the power that they hold so dear. They will be sentenced to a life of imprisonment, with no chance of release, forever left to be as weak as a common cold. I hesitated for a moment when I heard that, thinking, isn't there a chance that they will be able to level up while they're imprisoned, slowly getting their power back until they can ascend once again? Dana smirked when she heard that, looking up at the sky. You know, I had the same question. To answer this question, I called on a couple of reliable helpers. This is one of the key modifications made to the Reset Protocol's cloning vat. Every clone produced in this vat has a special title applied to them, Unforgiven Sinner. This title was specifically created by Ashley and implemented through the system with only one effect. After she said that, she turned to look at me. The bearer of the title is unable to gain experience to level up in any form. The level and class system is completely disabled for them. Even if they somehow managed to escape from the prison, even if they use some archaic method of invading someone's soul to possess them, as long as the system recognizes that they are the same individual possessing this title, they will forever be stuck at level zero. To prevent this technology from being stolen and used by criminals, additional measures have been taken, ensuring that the cloning vat can only be activated by someone that possesses a title personally bestowed by Irena, one who carries out the sentence. This title has no effect other than to allow the activation of the cloning vats. My brow twitched when I heard that. Irena's going to be busy handing out that title, isn't she? Dana stuck her tongue out playfully. I already got confirmation from her. She said that it was a small price to pay for getting this working. Furthermore, not every cop will need it, only a small number for each station. She said that she'll manage it, somehow. Chapter 110. When Dana's reset protocol was released to law enforcement, there were mixed responses. Despite this technology coming directly from Olympus, there were quite a few people that were against its use. These people, typically those with considerably high levels themselves, claimed that it was unjust to remove someone's entire life of work, or that the technology could be turned against those whose crimes did not warrant such punishments. To this, Dana released a simple statement. If a powerful criminal refuses to allow themselves to be taken in to atone for their crimes and uses their power to harm others in the process, then they are utterly undeserving of the power granted to them by the world's system. In her words, the power granted by the world is essentially the power granted by the Keeper himself, and it should not be used to harm those under the Keeper's rule. She wasn't entirely wrong with how she worded things, but I would have probably chosen to do so differently. Regardless, most of the people objecting to this technology fell silent when she released her statement, apart from some of the more active individuals. Thankfully, Dana did not plan to release any additional statements, and the police were free to order the reset protocol as needed from Olympus. As for me, I decided to check in with Ashley's newest project, the inclusion of NPCs within the various existing games. Galahan grimaced as he looked at the request that appeared on his computer screen. "You want what?" he asked, a digital image of the world spirit Mary appearing on the screen.
"My apologies for the disturbance, Sir Galahan. Is there a problem with the previous request?" she asked, in a polite tone, to which Galahan gave a firm nod.
"Damn right there is. They're asking for a contradiction. Here, look at this." He pointed to the message that had come in from the Greater Pantheon. "In World Seed, they want to create an alien race that covers 6 different systems. According to the backstory that they sent me, this should be a peaceful race with a small standing army, having known only a few wars in its history. Now, this latest request is asking for a special NPC character to be included in this kingdom. This NPC should be an expert and veteran of war, having fought numerous battles in his career to earn the title of Bloody Iron General. This is a clear contradiction to the nature and history of the Empire that they asked for."
Mary paused, looking over the request.
I see. I believe that they are just trying to include an NPC to the world setting that they feel will drive the plot and player interaction.
Is it entirely impossible to have such a character?
The idea of the character from the start is a contradiction, Galahan exclaimed, throwing his hands into the air.
There were a few things that irked him in the world as much as a contradiction in a story.
If you want to have a battle maniac, fine, but don't go and give him a history that goes against the overall lore of the world he is born into.
Mary gave a small nod of agreement.
How would you handle something like this, then? She asked, curiously, while trying to fulfill the wishes of the client as much as possible.
Galahan groaned before stroking his chin.
First, let's do the Empire. You always want to work from the top down. As long as you do so, you will have the theme of your world history and can fit characters into it accordingly.
As he said that, the scenery around them changed, his office vanishing to become a series of six stars.
This empire, Noblon, has had a peaceful progression to the Stellar Age. This means that there are no neighboring races that would cause conflict with them. The main ruler of this empire is the Emperor, Shalist Noblin. But the true power behind the throne is his daughter. Born with an incredibly keen political mind, she advised her father from a young age, leading to the settlement of many colonies and overall improvement in the standard of living for the empire.
As he spoke, lines began to connect the six shining stars, before zooming in on the brightest, showing a continent, then further to show a palace wrapped around a mighty tree, and finally a beautiful young girl with long black hair. Mary gave another nod.
Are you going to say that she is secretly a cruel princess, and hired a bloodthirsty man to cause strife in the kingdom to solidify her rule?
What? No! That cliché is so overused. She is a genuinely kind soul, one who cares for the people in her empire. However, it is her intellect that led her to realize that her empire's army would stand no chance against a true invading force.
When Galahan said this, a troubled look appeared on the girl's expression, and she rose to her feet, calling out to one of her servants.
She knew what the army needed, a true warrior. One who held both strength and honor, and was unafraid of war. What would such an individual look like in this empire?
Mary watched, blinking curiously as the scene changed. The princess was walking through a dark stone hallway, lit with only a few torches. From within her dress, she produced an iron key, unlocking a large door. Beyond the door was a tangle of roots, wrapping around and digging into the flesh of a man with dark red hair and bright blue eyes.
"You are Grendel Seluced, correct?"
the princess spoke, mirroring the words that Galahan mouthed.
"The princess, huh?" the inmate chuckled. "To what do I owe this pleasure? I would bow, but that's not really an option."
"That is perfectly all right."
The princess shook her head. The scene appeared to have come alive, even without Galahan saying anything.
"I am here to speak with you. According to my sources, your crime is beating to death three lesser nobles of the Empire, one of whom was your lord."
"That's right," Grendel grunted, nodding his head.
At least he was able to move that much with the roots binding him.
"Are you here to give me a heavier sentence?"
Ignoring him, the princess continued.
"The reason for your outburst was because you discovered that the nobles were abducting young men and women from their territories, stealing them from their families, and visiting various atrocities upon them."
Grendel's body stiffened when he heard that, some of the wounds where roots were stabbed into him torn open and bleeding.
"I don't know what you're talking about. I acted out of my own will."
The princess merely smiled.
"Sir Grendel Solist, the crime for a knight who betrayed his lord is to be fed to the imperial tree for 3 years, at which point the criminal will have long expired. You have been here for 6 weeks so far. I come to you with an offer."
When Grendel looked up at the princess, she continued,
"The Empire is in dire need of you. You who will act against injustice, even if it means violating your oath. You who are unafraid to sully your hands in the blood of others. With the Empire's recent expansion, we need one of your qualities. In time, we are likely to face a cruel enemy,
one who does not share our peaceful beliefs. If that time comes, we will not need a peaceful soul to lead us. Instead, we will need a warrior, one who understands the harshness of the world and can fight against those who would do us harm. I have the power to withdraw your sentence. In return, I ask that you become my knight, train my men to become proper soldiers, able to fight more than merely the roaming monsters of our lands. Furthermore, as my knight, you will have the authority to root out the hidden evil that rests within our lands, and ensure that no more families suffer due to the greed of those in power. Grendel gave a dull chuckle when he heard that.
Careful, princess. You're unleashing a rabid dog, you know. If you're not careful, I might turn against you.
The princess's smile grew, and she bent down to remove a dagger strapped to her ankle. This dagger bore a circular pommel engraved with the image of a great tree. Once the dagger was in hand, the roots quietly removed themselves from Grendel's body, surprising him. Meanwhile, the princess calmly walked over, placing the dagger in his hand and bringing it to her throat. By the name of Olivia Noblin, if one day you find my conduct to be unbecoming of my station, it is my sincere hope that you see that I am punished, she said, with that same gentle smile. Mary let out a soft gasp as the scene changed again. This time Grendel could be seen adorned in silver armor, green branch-like patterns engraved into it.
By order of Her Royal Highness, I am here to exact justice upon those who prey upon the weak, he called out, facing a great mansion.
Behind Grendel stood 50 soldiers, all of whom had solemn expressions on their faces. However, there was no answer from within the mansion. Thus Grendel drew his sword, a familiar circular pommel attached to it.
Your crimes are as follows. 6 counts of murder, 3 confirmed counts of ordering an assassination, 18 confirmed counts of kidnapping. To answer for these crimes, you will be sentenced to the Imperial Tree.
The pommel of his sword began to glow, and the mansion shook as giant roots pierced up and through the entire building. One root pierced through the shoulder of a screaming man, clutching at his shoulder as he was suspended in the air.
You can't do this! Don't you know who I am? You're just the princess's bloodhound!
That's exactly right, Grendel agreed, without any complaints. I came here following the scent of blood, and I am to enact the judgment of the palace upon this place.
As he said that, the roots withdrew, dragging the screaming noble beneath the surface. The scene shifted once again, Grendel walking into a large office and falling to one knee.
My lady, your knight has returned.
The princess sat at her desk, smiling. I am glad to see that you are well, Sir Solist. With this, the last of the corrupted nobles should be dealt with. I would like you to start focusing more on training the troops from now on, if you think that you are capable.
As you wish. Grendel nodded his head, eyes lowered.
The scene pulled back, showing the palace, the continent, the planet, and then the 6 stars once again.
And like that, you have a true warrior knight within an empire known for its peaceful history.
Mary nodded her head, looking impressed. Why not submit this scene to the design team? Surely they would be able to appreciate it, even if it did not meet their exact standards.
Galahan huffed when Mary asked that. Perhaps. I'll need to redesign a few characters, but it won't contradict the overall flow of the story.
Mary smiled politely at that, before voicing a question. Pardon me, but it seemed there as if you stopped narrating for a while. I must admit that I'm not familiar with your process, so I was just curious what happened. Galahan blinked before shrugging his shoulders.
I've said before, when you get the overall scene established, the characters can write themselves. There are actors in every script that are never seen, yet their existence is always implied. The architects that make the buildings, the farmers that grow the wheat to make the bread the heroes eat. Even if a character is never shown, their existence can be inferred due to the traces that they left behind. When you start from the top, you can create these characters on a large scale. And once enough information is provided, the world takes on its own life. I have 2 main jobs when creating any story.
The first is to be the one to set the story in place, determining the key facts that will shape this story and give it such life. The second is to find scenes from different times and places within this new world to show to the audience. I could show you a scene of the princess bathing, and many people might enjoy it. But would it serve to push the plot forward as much as the scene where the princess realized the importance of a true warrior in her empire's army?
Chapter 111.
Huh. So he was being literal when he said that the story would write itself, I muttered from my office, having deployed my world sight to watch Galahan. For powers like his or Lifra's, it might actually be more efficient for them to work backwards from the final result that they wished to achieve, such as what Galahan showed. Of course, that wasn't to say that there was only one way of doing things. Everyone had their own methods, even if they had similar sets of skills, and I was not going to try to disparage their methods. For instance, I couldn't see Galahan thrusting himself into his stories the way Lifra plunges into adventure. As Galahan was finishing up his scene, Tsubaki informed me that the censoring of contaminated information had been finished on the Internet. Once again, I was left to marvel at how advanced this device from Bellarose must have been. We could very likely learn a lot from studying it, but it seemed to be founded on a different method of thinking than what we were used to. In a way, it was like how we had to adapt to different types of sphere devices when we received the trade from Oldbeard. We were able to create an interface for Bellarose's device, but had no way to properly understand it without a considerable time investment.
So, what are you going to do now? Aurevi asked Dana with a grin, sitting next to the small elf in the communal room of Olympus.
Julia was off tending to the garden, so Aurevi took the time to spend a moment with one of her other friends. Dana thought to herself, trying to figure out what she wanted to do now that her reset protocol was completed. There were certainly different options, but she didn't know exactly what path to take.
I could work on one of my other projects, but I think most of them are pretty outdated by today's standards. She had a mild tone of complaint in her voice.
With everything that had happened with the Hyperlane Network, all of her spacefaring plans had to be scrapped, because they hadn't taken into account the problems that would arise from these new developments. The rest of her projects were either fanciful dreams she didn't think that she could realize, or just small objects to tinker with as a hobby.
"Why don't you help me with one of mine, then?"
Aurevi asked playfully, causing Dana to look over at her with a curious expression.
"What sort of projects are you working on?"
Dana knew that Aurevi had always had her own projects. In some ways, she was actually a genius inventor. She had been the one to create Traveler, the instance dungeon core that Dale held, and even the cores that sparked the Dungeon Master battles in history. She was sure that there were still countless more creations of Aurevi's around the world.
"Oh, loads of stuff," Aurevi said with a light laugh. "I pick up projects whenever I get inspiration, and set them down whenever I lose it. Right now, what I'm working on is something that I call the Automatic Dungeon Generator. It's an old project of mine, but I never quite managed to get it working."
"Why? What's wrong with it?" Dana asked, her curiosity further piqued by the idea. Dungeons were undeniably Aurevi's specialty, so for her to be having trouble with something, she wasn't sure how she would be able to contribute.
"What I'm looking for is a publicly accessible dungeon that will adjust its difficulty based on the level of the participants. This is sort of what we originally wanted for Fior, a training ground that anyone could use, regardless of level. However, over time, the look of Fior changed. Nowadays, only the strongest go there, while the other floors are mostly cleared of any major threats and left as residential zones."
Dana's eyes widened slightly when she heard what the project was really about.
Automatically assigning difficulty. Did you plan to get Ashley involved?
"Not really. I want this to be something that can be made without getting the system involved. For instance, I want to copy the trick of instanced dungeons to let multiple parties into the dungeon at once, each in their own instance. I have monster and trap generation handled, thanks to the dungeon cores. What I'm missing is exactly that difficulty adjuster. I need some type of item or spell that will look at the levels of the participants and construct a suitable challenge for them. At the same time, I'd like to include a safety mechanism in the dungeon, so that people will be ejected from the dungeon after taking a serious injury. It might not be able to save everyone, but it would go a long way towards it. Dana gave a small nod of her head, but pursed her lips. Why not just make a virtual training program instead?
If you have the user synchronize their virtual and real selves, then any training that they do in the program will carry over to the real world.
Aravi stuck her tongue out for a moment. Because I want something to get people out of the virtual world. There are so many things these days to incentivize people to spend most of their time logged into games, whether it is to have fun, make money, or grow stronger. The more people get into games, the less invested they will be in the outside world. If I can get this dungeon working, it can be a training ground for aspiring adventurers. I've just got to get the difficulty setting fixed.
Dana let out a small sigh, understanding Aravi's complaint. In fact, she and the others had been quite absorbed into fragments of Acidia for a while, which had led to the formation of an entire machine empire. Sadly,